Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
In Brooklyn's Borum Hill, lines were moving slowly in the packed, drab, gray building. Jasmine Headley just wanted to get a voucher for city-funded daycare so she could find someone to look after her one-year-old son while she went to work as a cleaner. Instead, Headley, 23, ended up behind bars because sick and tired of being sick and tired, the young mother sat on the floor because there were no seats available in the crowded room. Next, Headley was lying on the floor, surrounded by New York City police officers and security guards, holding her one-year-old son firmly in her arms as the officers forcibly tried to yank the child away. "They're hurting my son," she screams again and again. One officer pulls out a stun gun. Headley was charged with resisting arrest, acting in a manner injurious to a child, obstructing government administration, and criminal trespass. Letitia James, now the New York State Attorney General, commented, No mother should have to experience such trauma and humiliation. Being poor is not a crime, but actually it is.
In Ferguson, Missouri, in addition to exposing racially biased policing, the Justice Department's Ferguson report exposed to the world a system of fines and fees levied for minor crimes that, what they proved too expensive for Ferguson's largely poor African-American population, resulted in jail sentences for thousands of people. Ferguson is everywhere in America today. Through money, bond, bail systems, fees and fines, strictly enforced laws and regulations against behavior, including trespassing and public urination that largely affect the homeless, and the substitution of prisons and jails for the mental hospitals that have traditionally served the impoverished. In one of the richest countries of the earth, we have effectively made it a crime to be poor.
We're building bridges to Professor Peter Edelman, who famously resigned from the administration of Bill Clinton over welfare reform, who discusses his new book, Not a Crime to be Poor. And Professor Edelman connects the dots between these policies and others, including school discipline in poor communities, child support policies affecting the poor, public housing ordinances, addiction treatment, and the spectra of public benefits fraud to paint a picture of a mean-spirited, retributive system that seals whole communities into inescapable cycles of poverty and then criminalizes the residents of those communities.
But first, we go to a New York City Hall press conference protesting the arrest and jailing of Jasmine Headley. We hear first from City Council Speaker Corey Johnson and then Majority Leader Lori Cumbo.
Our Speaker of the City Council, Corey Johnson.
It is absolutely necessary that we gather here today. I felt immediately heartbroken for Ms. Headley and for her baby boy, and furious at what I saw. But it shows what is wrong in our system. How disheartening it is to try and receive benefits for which you're entitled. How overflowing these offices are with people who need help, and how one incident can escalate so quickly that sends a young mother to jail and a child into ACS custody. We saw how our system criminalizes poverty and separates parents from children without considering the lasting damage that will occur to these parents and children. Anyone who saw it has an obligation to speak out and to make our system better, to fight for changes that will help families like Jasmine Headley's. I just heard our majority leader, Lori Cumbo, speak from the perspective of being a black woman with a 17-month-old black child, and to hear her speak so passionately, so emotionally, from the perspective of a black woman with a small baby, to me indicates the structural racism that is involved in our systems here in New York City, and the importance to acknowledge that. I will be meeting with the Department of Social Services Commissioner, Steve Banks, and the NYPD Commissioner, James O'Neill, to get to the bottom of this, to understand how this could have happened, and what we can do as a city to make sure that it never happens again. We also have an obligation to, of course, look at the big picture of what we're talking about, but to also immediately help Jasmine Headley and her baby. This should have never happened. She should be released from Rikers Island immediately and reunited with her one-year-old baby. Yeah. That is what should be done. Release her.
Release her now. Release her now.
And every,
release her now.
And every,
release her now.
Every leader in this city should be saying that.
Release her now. Release her now. Release her now.
Our majority leader, Lori Cumbo.
I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning and got my son ready because we had to go in front of HRA today to protest, send a message loud and clear that black women matter. Nobody understands how difficult it is to be a black woman in New York City, in America. As Malcolm X said, we are the most vulnerable. We are the most antagonized. We are the most neglected. We are the most disrespected in this entire country. And for that woman, our Jasmine Headley, yes. Each one of us are her. I have a 16-month-old son, and I can't imagine, because I would have fought just as hard as she did to hold on to my son, yep. If that had happened to me.
Yep.
And yep. Some people, these trolls are saying, why didn't she just stand up?
No, no.
Why didn't someone offer her a seat?
That's right.
Treat people with dignity, with respect, that they matter, with humanity. And that's why we are out here today, of all races, of all nationalities, because we have to send a message loud and clear. Those officers made a calculated decision that by removing Jasmine from her son, waving around tasers, that there would be no repercussions. We are angry. We are mad as hell. We don't want some bogus investigation that's going to tell us we didn't see what we saw on the investigation on the video. We saw the video. Everybody saw the video, just like we saw the Eric Garner video. And we are not taking it anymore. We are fed up. We are going to keep out until Jasmine comes home and until those officers, they are fired. That's the least of what should happen. And we should not continue to victimize Jasmine. We have to send a message loud and clear. You do not attack black women. You do not attack any women in the city of New York. And that's where we stand as a council, and that's where we stand as a body. We have this can never happen again to another mother in the city of New York. Thank you.
Release her now. Release her now. Release her now. Release her now.
Well, we know that Jasmine Headley, through public pressure, was indeed released. But we're joined by Professor Peter Edelman, policymaker, law professor at Georgetown University Law Center. And as I said, there's few people who have the kind of expertise, fields of poverty, welfare, juvenile justice, and constitutional law, and has written an enormously important book, Not a Crime to Be Poor. And I should say, as a humble legal aid lawyer in the civil division, Professor Edelman, we're all eagerly waiting to hear the things that you have to say, because we face this every day, and that is the criminalization of poverty.
Well, here we are. I mean, this is so powerful. What a terrible thing Ms. Headley went through. And yeah, I hope it does have the effect that the people who came out and protested and makes a difference for the price that she has paid for this. It fortunately made so much attention that she was released and she's back with her child, and that's good. But this is everything that's wrong. Put it in a context. The largest group of people who live in poverty in our country are women and children. Higher than African American, higher than Latino, Native American, The largest group are women, and that includes, by the way, white women with children, very, very high, over 40%. That's just astonishing. And indeed, as the poverty's gone down a little bit, as the recession kind of has gone back, it hasn't gone back below 40%. So that's the heart of it. And the heart of the heart is that, as bad as welfare was back in the days when there was a legal right to have it, and President Clinton came along and the Congress and they passed TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Families. Now we have gone down, just, and this connects to the 40%. The number of people who are now getting cash assistance in our country, we want jobs for people. We don't want people to have cash assistance unless they just can't find a job. And indeed, they can't find a job very often because they don't have child care. And that's what this was about Ms. Headley. Her child care had been cut off, and she didn't know why. Apparently just a computer glitch or something. And she came down there to get help. Well, you can't. You're a single mom, and you want to work. You got to have child care. Well, she was doing it right, and they took it away from her. So that's the heart of that. But when Clinton became president, we had 14.3 million people on cash assistance welfare. And I think that's too high because we really were not helping sufficiently for people to get jobs. It's now under 3 million people in the country. That's less than 1% of the population of the country. And we're talking about deep poverty here. Now, we now have 7 million people in this country whose only income is from a food stamp, is from SNAP, and that means less than $6,000 or about $6,000 a year for families of three. So that's what was done by TANF, and that has left us with over 15 million people whose incomes are less than half the poverty level, under $10,000 for a family of three. So this is the heart of the numbers, and it's national. And you know, here we are, you are in New York with this awful thing happens. And in fact, it's actually better than it is in other parts of the country, if you can believe that. I mean, we're down to the fact in states like Wyoming, Mississippi, Texas, big Texas, under the 5%, 5 out of 100 children living in low-income poverty families are getting TANF, are getting cash assistance. There was a right of it under a system that didn't work very well, but there was a legal right to it. There is not that anymore, and so we're down to under $3 million. So that's what we have, and it's in a context of racism, because who is hit by all of this? It's people of color, and of course women. So it's sexist as well. That's the larger story that goes with Jasmine Headley. Maybe I should stop there because there's a lot more to talk about.
No, actually don't. I think it's important that you continue the narrative because the issue of poverty and certainly the link between criminalization of poverty or because of poverty is barely on the lips of the populace. And so flesh out for more the kind of details or how the Jasmine Headley's manifests itself in many other areas.
There are two different things here. They certainly all connect into the criminalization of poverty. The one thing, it's the things that go with the story that we've talked about, Ms. Headley, which is just plain mean. And it doesn't have to do with money, which I want to talk about, money to get money into the coffers of states and cities and so on. But all these other things where we're just being mean. And that's true here. I mean, it isn't just that it's very hard to get the TANF. You know, you go into the office anywhere in the country and you try to get TANF and SNAP and all of those things. And state after state, they line you up. You have to wait all day. They tell you to go back the next day. How do we get down from 14 million to 3 million? In part because you just can't get there to get the help. So when we talk about other things that really are not about the fines and fees and not about the bail, which I'll talk about, but why is it that we're now sending kids, and they're disproportionately African-American, instead of being sent to the principal's office, as they used to be, we have the school officers who arrest kids, and they get sent to juvenile court, and in Texas and Wyoming into adult court for some little fracas on a playground. It's the same underlying attitude about people, the feeling that they're not respected, and worse. We're talking about almost 300,000 people a year, kids, get sent to court for something that should have gone to the principal's office. We have a problem that you have in parts of New York is ordinances where if a woman calls 911 too often, the police have the power to tell the landlord to throw the person out, to evict them. It's insane. These are people who are calling to get protection about there might be violence against them, and instead they end up evicted. The ACLU is doing major work on that, and a lot of these things, people do fight back, and that's so important.
I just want to point out to clarify that a little bit. Very often what happens in public housing and so on is that if a woman is subject to domestic violence and calls the police, the landlord may deem, because of the disruption that follows, quote-unquote, that she is a nuisance, and uses that as a basis for commencing eviction proceedings, whether in an administrative case in public housing or in the private housing sector in the city courts, which is, the criminalization.
But let's be clear about that. There's a lot of research that's been done where the landlord did not want to throw the person out.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a travesty. And, of course, my office defends against that. But it's part of your whole thesis and issues of, again, the criminalization of people who are in impoverished states.
Yeah, I just want to get into some of the ways that the government takes money away from poor people and in some cases locks them up if they can't pay. Yeah. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this whole list of things that we've talked about here, which aren't about money, the police and others and bureaucrats and others, not for any really excusable thing at all. The second thing happened here, and, you know, I worked on the poverty issues that we've been talking about today for decades. I was not aware of what we discovered in Ferguson. Starting with the anti-tax rebellion it's really the Reagan period when it starts, states and court systems and municipalities were starving for money, and what they did, it's a time of paying for a lot of kinds of things that used to be there as services, and so they built up these enormous fines and fees, which if somebody gets arrested for literally telling an actual story, a man who is intellectually disabled, and he was just burning the leaves in his backyard, and he didn't have a permit for that, and the police came and took him down to the court, and he was hit for a $500 fee and a $500 so-called fees, probation that isn't probation, and of course he couldn't pay for it. Well, as the story goes on, fortunately, he did finally get a lawyer, which is extremely, extremely important. The biggest part of this kind of thing, of throwing people in jail when they can't pay a fine, and it's a fine that has been jacked up, and these things, and you pay for everything. Just heard a story about in Missouri about a man who owes now in the thousands of dollars because he can't pay for the bed and board in the county jail. I mean, it's paying for everything. It's just crazy. They charge for probation in 44 states in this country. It's just shocking. And the biggest thing is taking away people's driver's licenses. More than 40 states do that. And that works really well from their point of view because people have to use their car. And so they drive to work. They have to take the kids to school or whatever it might be, and they get arrested again. And it goes up and up and up, and there are all these absolutely made-up fees that go with it. The result of it is you have 10 million people in this country who owe $50 billion in all of this stuff. And the state of California that's getting a little better about it, but they took away the driver's licenses of 4 million people. Nationally, of that 10 million people owing all that money, 7 million of those are people who lost their driver's licenses on something that has nothing to do with safety. Be very clear about this. This isn't about driving under the influence. This is getting money to pay for running the government. It's just absolutely all over the country, almost 2 million people in Texas, et cetera, et cetera. If you're in juvenile, they have fines and fees all over the country. You know, I was the commissioner of juvenile stuff in New York in the 70s, and I just couldn't believe that this was happening. You know, it's not services, it's squeezing people for money. It's modern peonage. It's big business. Two out of every three people who get inmates who get out owe unpaid fines and fees, including fees for their stays. And it's just crazy. You have an understanding that we have mass incarceration, but we really don't know that this is a national problem where the fines and fees and bail, which we haven't had time about, right. And certainly knowing about Rikers, of course, people know about bail. 700,000 people every day are in jails around the country, and 450,000 of those people are not in for anything. They're just being there waiting to be tried because they can't pay the bail. These are small, tiny things, misdemeanors, violations. They're not a threat to anybody. It's about, again, about getting money. And indeed, what happens then is the person can't get out, so they plead. What happens when you plead? You get a payment plan. And that, again, is this whole system to make money to run whatever it is, the court system or the municipality or so on. So the bail issue, which is beginning to become an issue in your state with the new members of the legislature, and this is something for people to really get involved about it, because new laws should be, now it should be possible to get new laws to reform the bail system in New York State. So you put all these things together. We didn't talk whether it was homelessness. I mean, it just goes everywhere. Homeless people get thrown into jail over and over and over again. They're not allowed to sleep anywhere. And the main part is that those cities, and it happens city after city around the country, is to make sure that they leave that town, that they'll have to find some other place. And so this hits just so many places between shaking people down on the money side to the because of being starved for revenues, and then all these other things that are just awful for people that really don't have any justification. So this is all what I've written in my book, and I really appreciate the chance that I could talk with you about it.
I appreciate the chance, and I will tell you one of the most striking ones that I recently came across was a $100 surcharge for what they call aggressive begging. So if you go into a night court anytime in Brooklyn or any of the boroughs, you will see homeless people who are picked up and possibly for begging, etc., but generally being homeless. And then they are brought before the DAs and stuff, and they are put right back into the into jail by virtue of they are assessed a $100 surcharge. Now, let me see if I understand that. They are homeless, and they've
yes,
been picked
right.
up for quote-unquote begging,
right.
And then they are assessed a $100 surcharge. So what I want to know, you have been a policy analyst. You've been in the highest level of government, which you chose to leave, which I commend you for, after the horrible 1996 Welfare Reform and Reconstruction Act, which was anything but. So what do you see as being accomplished, and what do you want to see happen as a result of this enormously important book, Not a Crime to Be Poor? Everybody has to get it. It is digestible. It is readable. It is strategic. We have to understand this is a feminist issue. We have to understand the link between poverty and the criminalization of the poor. Not a crime to be poor. What is to be done, Professor Peter Edelman?
The first thing is that there continues to be a challenge they need to know about these fines and fees, because that can be knocked down, as people, advocates and so on, have in some states made a difference on that. It needs people fighting back. But what the lawyers are doing, and even some of the judges and some of the legislators, it needs the people to understand this. That's on the side of the fines and fees and the bail and the driver's license. On the rest of it, which is really about all the other aspects of poverty and the sort of public policy that goes with them, what we need to understand is that these are real people. There is such an attitude, such a belief that this is some different kind of person who has low income, and therefore there's something must be terrible about them because they have a low income. And that's a trouble and that we've had to get people to understand that people want to work. The vast majority, and you know, comes along somebody telling some story about somebody, and they were lazy and all that, and just over and over again. So that is not easy, but we have to take it on. And I hope with this new House of Representatives that we have in Washington, that some of these wonderful people who've been elected are going to start talking about these things as well as many other things that are very important, and have that be a place that gets it out around the country. And then, you know, I hope that we're getting to, over the course of 2020 and thereafter, a different country that's good about saving our environment and climate change and all these other things, but certainly about doing something good about poverty.
I keep thinking of, since the general reality of the contempt for the poor, the fact that there really is a tale of two cities, and now the additional reality of whether for social control or for propping up the coffers of the city treasuries, the idea of the criminalization of the poor is just absolutely, absolutely tyrannical, autocratic, anti-democratic in the extreme. I'm so glad that you have exposed this terrifying problem that is upon us, and you do so with such lucidity and such knowledge, really exploding the myth of equal treatment across class lines. People, you got to get it. It really is a book. It should be similarly as popular as Michelle Alexander's book was on incarceration, mass incarceration. Not a crime to be poor, because guess what? That's an irony. It darn well is in our society. And Peter Edelman explodes it. The criminalization of poverty in America. Peter Edelman, thank you for the work that you've done all these many years. Thank you for this very important book, Not a Crime to be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. It has been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, for me as well. Thank you so much.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.